Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. News.
Talks on a defense agreement between the Czech Republic and the United States could begin next month. Czech politicians have congratulated Emmanuel Macron, and an ex-MP has been found guilty of Holocaust denial. Talks on a defense agreement between the Czech Republic and the United States could begin in the second half of next month, the Czech Deputy Minister of Defense Jan Havranek said in Washington. Mr. Havranek will head a negotiating team comprising officials from the Ministries of Defense and Foreign Affairs, as well as other Czech agencies. The Czech Minister of Defense, Jana Černochová, and her U.S. counterpart, Lloyd Austin, discussed plans for a defense cooperation agreement between the two sides in the U.S. Capitol on Thursday. Czech Prime Minister Petr Fiala congratulated French President Emmanuel Macron for his re-election on Sunday. Mr. Fiala wrote on Twitter that he wished Mr. Macron all the best and further accomplishments as president. France is a vital partner for the Czech Republic, says Mr. Fiala, and the Czech government is keen on developing the great relationship between the two countries further. Foreign Minister Jan Lipavský wished Mr. Macron all the best for the next 5 years of service, and President Zeman, with regard to Ukraine, said he hoped Mr. Macron would continue with his endeavours with regard to Russia and its president. The French leader has spoken to the Kremlin chief several times. A court in Prague has found former MP Miloslav Rozner guilty of Holocaust denial over a statement he made about Leti, a World War II concentration camp for Romanies in southern Bohemia. Mr. Rozner, who is from Tomio Okamura's Freedom and Direct Democracy, got a suspended sentence for calling Leti a non-existent pseudo-concentration camp in 2017. The one-time deputy said he'd merely criticised the government decision to buy a pig farm on the site. Mr. Rozner may appeal the verdict. Checks on the margins on foodstuffs launched by the Czech Ministry of Agriculture and the Office for the Protection of Competition will not succeed in halting price rises, says the Association of Bakers and Confectioners. In a statement on Monday, it said its members had seen costs of producing breads rise by 75% year on year. The association said a number of firms in the sector had either ceased or suspended their activities and that the existence of other bakeries was under threat. 594 new cases of COVID-19 were recorded in the Czech Republic on Sunday. That was the lowest daily tally since October 10th. There were also 114 suspected reinfections. Sunday saw 727 people in Czech hospitals with the coronavirus. 42 are in a critical condition. The seven-day case incidence rate was at 128 per 100,000. Prague has the highest infection rate in the country, while the Liberec region has the lowest. Finally, a look at the weather forecast. It should be mainly overcast in the Czech Republic on Tuesday with an average high temperature of 13 degrees Celsius. Similar weather is expected over the following week. My name is Ian Willoughby, and that is the end of the news.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. I'm Anna Fodor, broadcasting from my studio here in Prague. Coming up on today's programme: the Czech reaction to Macron's re-election. Prague St. Vitus Cathedral receives a reliquary of Emperor Charles I. And later, we meet František Vrabel, who says his company monitors disinformation almost for free because he doesn't want to end up being ruled by the Russians again. All that coming up, so please stay with us. Czech politicians have welcomed French President Emmanuel Macron's election victory over his far-right rival Marine Le Pen, hailing it as good news for Europe and a signal of stability in turbulent times. My colleague Daniela Lazarová spoke to Zuzana Šimek from the Prague-based Association for International Affairs about the implications of this victory and what it may mean for Czech-French relations.
His victory in the presidential election is a very good news for Europe, for the European Union, but also for the Czech Republic. Emmanuel Macron is a pro-European head of state. We have seen his proactive approach recently when he was involved in searching for a peaceful solution to the war in Ukraine. He is a constructive partner when negotiating about the situation in Ukraine, but also at European level, talking about other challenges related, for example, to climate change, energy crisis, etc.
To what do you attribute the extremely high support for Le Pen in these elections? Is this a warning signal regarding the mood of French voters?
I think that Ms. Le Pen got this lesson from the previous election in 2017, when she was defeated. This time she managed to gather especially the votes from unsatisfied French people fed up with Macron and his reforms. She promised significant not only economic reforms but also restrictions towards immigrants, and all these program points are aimed at improving living standards of those French voters who suffer from the economic and social crisis caused by not only coronavirus pandemic, but also the situation in Ukraine.
What are the reactions to President Macron's victory here in the Czech Republic? Is it good news for the Czech Republic?
I would say it is great news, and last night, soon after the announcement of the election results, Czech Prime Minister Petr Fiala congratulated Mr. Macron on the re-election, and he also expressed his interest in developing French-Czech relations. The same message also from the Czech Minister of Foreign Affairs, Jan Lipavský. So this is for sure very good news for the future of Czech-French relations, especially if we talk about the French presidency of the EU Council, which will be followed by the Czech presidency. This is a great impetus for developing and deepening our bilateral relationship.
What is the state of Czech-French relations under President Macron? Are we fully using the potential that is there? Is France a close ally in the European Union?
I think we could use more than these relationships in order to cooperate closely, but we will see whether this re-election will help to, let's say, take it further. Our bilateral relations are built on the domains of the nuclear energy, business, defense, culture, education and science, and the nuclear energy has the potential to become again a key element of the relations, keeping in mind the current situation in the energy market.
That was my colleague Daniela Lazarova speaking to Susanna Šimek of the Association for International Affairs. On the occasion of the 100th anniversary of his death, a reliquary of Charles I, the last emperor of Austria-Hungary and thus also the last king of Bohemia, was ceremonially placed within the Cathedral of St. Vitus at Prague Castle on Sunday. Charles I is seen by the Church as an exemplary Christian monarch and was beatified by Pope John Paul II. His relic is now part of the country's most sacred national symbols that make up the so-called Treasure of St. Wenceslas. Tom McEncrow has the details.
Leading dignitaries such as the current head of the Habsburg-Lorraine family, Charles, or the charge d'affaires of the papal nuncio in the Czech Republic, Giuseppe Silvestrini, could be seen at Prague Castle on Sunday on the occasion of the placing of a reliquary of Bohemia's last king, Charles I, into the Cathedral of St. Vitus. Charles I died of pneumonia as an exiled monarch on the island of Madeira at the age of just 34 on April 1st, 1922, exactly 100 years ago. The head of the Czech branch of the Knights of St. George in the Czech Republic, Dr. Milan Novák, says that the reliquary contains a part of Charles I's rib.
While Charles I was being beatified, his tomb was opened and one of his ribs was collected. The bone was then moved to the Vatican, where individual pieces of the rib were placed into reliquaries. These are now being used to honour and worship the deceased monarch as a beatified Christian.
K poctě a k uctívání.
Charles I was declared blessed in a ceremony on St. Peter's Square by Pope John Paul II in 2004. Charles was described as a, I quote, Christian statesman by the Pope, who has since been declared a saint himself. Dr. Novak says that Charles's peace efforts during the First World War are especially prescient in current times. The monarch assumed power on November 21, 1916, replacing Emperor Franz Joseph, and ruled for less than 2 years until the breakup of the Habsburg state.
He inherited a multi-ethnic empire of 50 million people in the middle of Europe at a time of a worldwide general slaughter. A Christian in his heart and soul, he could not come to terms with what was happening, so he placed great effort into ending the conflict. He also tried to alleviate the burden of the war on the general population. Austria-Hungary was therefore the first country in the world to look for institutional solutions to these problems. Charles I founded the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Social Affairs. This was the first initiative of its kind in Europe.
Although never officially crowned Czech king, Charles I lived in Bohemia for several years before he became crown prince, says Dr. Novák.
He spent 4 years of his life in the Czech chateau of Brandýs nad Labem, where he moved in 1908 after being commissioned as a dragoons officer. He lived near Stará Boleslav, the site of the martyrdom of the Czech patron saint, Duke Wenceslas. As a practicing Catholic, he was very much introduced to this Czech tradition and identified with it. He also spoke very good Czech.
Although 19th century Czech politicians such as František Palacký were very much open to the idea of a reformed Austro-Hungarian monarchy, by the time of the First World War, the circle around the future first Czechoslovak president Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk was decidedly pro-independence. Charles would try to reclaim the Hungarian crown, but failed, in part due to Czechoslovak reluctance to allow a Habsburg back on a Central European throne. Together with his wife, Zita of Bourbon-Parma, Charles had 8 children. One of them was the heir to the Habsburg throne, Otto von Habsburg, who would later become an ardent proponent of European integration. The treasure of St. Wenceslas includes the skull of the country's patron saint, as well as that of his grandmother, St. Ludmilla, and a reliquary of St. Adalbert.
Just a reminder that you're listening to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio, where it's now time for our main feature of the day. František Vrábel runs a company crunching big data from all around the world. It also closely monitors Russian propaganda. And Mr. Vrábel explains why in this edition of One on One with Ian Willoughby.
František Vrábel is an expert on Russia's infiltration of Czech society via sophisticated online disinformation, something his international company, Semantic Visions, monitors very closely. At their offices in a lovely Art Nouveau building overlooking Prague's old Jewish cemetery, we discussed efforts to combat such propaganda and Facebook's role in spreading disinformation. But I first asked Vrábel, who's in his early 60s, a little about himself. My first question for you is, if you could tell us, please, something about your background. You grew up in Iraq.
Yes, my parents were teachers at the Baghdad University, and I spent a significant part of my childhood, the formative part of it, when I was from 8 till 11.
So I was reading that your dad was a trainer of some famous sports person.
Yeah, his most famous athlete that he trained was Ludvík Daněk, who was the Olympic winner, and he won the bronze and silver medals in 3 Olympic Games in a row.
How did it shape you growing up away from Czechoslovakia in this international environment?
It was, I would say, a very exciting experience, and I think it influenced me or impacted me big time. Simply, I could not be fond of history and archaeology because of the historical ancestry of Iraq, Mesopotamia. So, and my parents were good enough to show us or enable us to visit all the historical sites like Babylon or Nineveh or Persepolis and the like. I understood that the world has its history and that multiple cultures and multiple civilizations lived on the earth. And because I got a chance, a unique chance as a child from a communist country to see something completely different, like the Middle East, and because we also like visited like Western Europe, so I had pretty unique views of seeing at least three completely different cultures.
And was it hard then to kind of readjust back to Czechoslovakia after seeing all these things?
It was difficult because we returned back with parents in 1970, 2 years after the Russian occupation of Czechoslovakia. And yeah, it was difficult a lot, mainly to my parents or to our parents. My mother was fired from the university. And although my father remained, they had difficulties in their jobs. My father later on declined on being part of the doping program of Czechoslovakia, which started in the 70s. We are three brothers. My brother was allowed to study at the university what he wanted to study. This was not my case. I had already difficulties to get to the high school. And the university which I graduated from was not my first choice, but let's put it diplomatically. And my younger brother, he was not allowed to attend even the high school.
You also worked at a collective farm, I understand.
Yes, I did. This was in the second half of the 80s. Actually, I was graduated as a teacher, and I was not considered to be a trusted member of the society.
How did you end up in the field that you're in now, which is data analysis?
Well, when the political change happened, after a short period of me being part of the new democratic governing structure, I decided that politics is not my field. And we founded first company with my brother, and we were real estate developers. And when we finished a big project after 6 or 7 years, I didn't want to continue in that, and I wanted to do something more, I would say, intellectual. I started to invest into IT, information technologies, and namely information security. We were recognized by the U.S. military, and we started to work in the framework of U.S. foreign military assistance. So this is my way to the big data analysis.
And if I understand it right, your company, Semantic Visions, which, by the way, is a fantastic company name, I must say, you guys both study or research disinformation and identify potential problems for supply chains for corporations. Is that correct?
It is correct. And we started with the latter. And what we do, or what we achieved in automatic and real-time disinformation detection, is, I would say, a side effect or collateral benefit or implementation of the technology that we originally developed for the supply chain disruption predictions.
Your company's mission statement says Semantic Visions is committed to, and I quote, safeguarding democracy through detection of disinformation and adversarial propaganda. So clearly it isn't just a business for you. What is your motivation in doing this kind of work?
Yes, it is not a real business for us because although there's a lot of buzz about the need of fighting disinformation, there's very few customers that would be ready to pay for it. So most of the work that we do is for free, and this reflects our social responsibility and also my experience that I don't want to get back into the time when Russians would govern this country.
Your company is, and I quote, operating in the front line of the information war with Russia. When do you feel that Russia's war, information war, as we see it today, began?
I would say the first sign of something very strong was back in 2008, when the Czech government considered to build or to invite United States to build the radar as part of the defense against Russian nuclear missiles. And then there was like several years, it was like pretty calm. And then it suddenly, there was a sudden burst of hostile propaganda from Russian side and disinformation with respect to annexation of Crimea in 2014 and the beginning of the Russian aggression in the eastern Ukraine at the same year. So when that happened, I was looking to the system and try to find traces or signs that something like that would have happened, if we would be able to recognize it based on our data. And I concluded that yes. For example, we saw that Russians were active in the information space and did artillery information preparation 2.5 years before. Not against Czech citizens or German citizens or American citizens, but against their own population to change or the sentiment Russians had to Ukraine.
How effective are the Russians at information warfare? I've got to say, to me, as a layperson, they seem like terribly good at it.
Unfortunately, they are excellent, and it is in a, a big contrast to their physical capabilities, I mean military capabilities. The roots or their knowledge of the information warfare goes back to 50s of last century when KGB established a special department of black operation of black propaganda, and they call it disinformatia. So the word disinformation comes from Russian language. And there was a scientific research being conducted in the Soviet Union on this, how to manipulate the minds of people or of masses of people by remote. And what we see now is the result of this long-term research and also practice. The reason why Russians are so successful is, unfortunately, mainly due to the online platforms, which basically all of them are American at the time being.
Since February 24th, the Czech Republic has tried to fight back to some degree by blocking some disinformation sites. Is that proving effective, do you feel?
I think it was a good decision. It is proving to be a correct decision from the standpoint of minimizing or decreasing the strength of the stream of propaganda disinformation from Russia. The estimates are that it went down to 50%. But having said that, the web portals that were blocked, or the ones by the CZ domain operator, and the others that were blocked by internet service providers, this has only a limited impact on the Russian disinformation operations, because most of it is being done on Facebook. And there is no, Facebook is doing really nothing, literally nothing against it. And this part of, the information domain is completely available to the Russians.
Well, you've been saying for some time that Facebook should be regulated, but I wonder sometimes if it's possible to put that genie back in the bottle, so to speak. Facebook has become this monster. Is it possible to, in some way, rein it in?
I believe so, and I'm trying my best to explain how or why Facebook is so bad, and that regulating Facebook could have nothing in common with freedom of speech or censorship, if you like. And that the problem is not in stopping dissemination of the posts, like censorship, but in the other part of Facebook algorithmic factory, which is amplification of the disinformation. And currently, the algorithms work in a way that the more aggressive the message or the post is, the more radical the content is, the more polarizing the content is, the more emotional and more fearful the content is, or the article, the post is, the more this content is being spread within the network. So if there's something really harmful, like a false news or post that Ukrainians are killing Russian children and putting them into mass graves and the like, or crucifying them. This is being inherently boosted by Facebook algorithms, and this false claims or harmful content is multiplied 1,000 times or 10,000 times or 100,000 times. So this is the real problem. And Facebook, unfortunately, with all its lobbying power, and I would say also not understanding of the political leadership, is still protecting its monster machine.
Do you think ordinary users like me, I'm on Facebook, I put up a picture of my dog sometimes, I like to see photos of my cousin's children, am I also contributing to the problem by being on it at all?
I think so, yes, but to a lesser extent than the founder, of course, Zuckerberg, Mark Zuckerberg, who has all the power to run the company, which is very exceptional or completely, I would say, almost unheard in case of public companies being listed on a stock exchange. So I think that the only way how to influence Facebook that it will start to behave properly and not destruct the society is when we as users start leaving Facebook and make our decisions public. So to vote by feet. I don't know if this is the English phrase as well, but this is certainly in Czech.
What's the future outlook? Are things going to get even worse in the coming years with regard to, I don't know, deep fakes and all these kind of things?
Certainly, unless we adopt a pretty strict regulation, which unfortunately will not happen, I think, in time. And the deep fakes is a real threat that is incomparably bigger than the current threat coming from, I would say, mainly textual disinformation.
And that was Ian Willoughby there speaking to František Vrábel, ending the programme for us today here on Radio Prague International. You'll find us on the web at www.radio.cz. If you have any comments about today's programme, we would love to hear from you. Please write to us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook or via Twitter. I'm Anna Fodor in Prague. Thanks for joining us and take care.